name is David Paulson. I'm a member of SABRE. Today is the 12th of March, 1999. I'm in Reston, Virginia, and I'm going to interview Mr. Mal Mallott. Mr. Mallott, how old are you?
Please call me Mal.
Okay, Mal, how old are you?
I'm 77, my base.
And were you brought up in Syracuse?
Just outside, in north of Syracuse, a suburb.
And when did you get interested in baseball?
By the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I'd read the box scores religiously.
Did you have a favorite team you rooted for?
I suppose the Yankees at that time, but it wasn't focused that carefully. I can remember when Bob Feller burst into the major leagues at age 15 or 16, whatever it was. See, that was Cleveland, so you follow Cleveland. The Cardinals had different stars. Detroit was very active in those days. And of course, the Yankees. The only time I ever skipped school was to see the Yankees play the Syracuse Chiefs in an exhibition. And that was Gehrig and that gang. So, not particularly a favorite, no.
Okay. And any special players that you...
Well, of course, Babe Ruth was all the rage. Lou Gehrig certainly was. They were the ones. Then the Detroit team at that time had Mickey Cochran and Charlie Gehringer and some of the folks like that.
Okay. And were you always a pitcher?
Always a pitcher, except in high school when we had too busy a schedule. I played first base a bit in addition to pitching 2 games a week. Yeah.
And you were a southpaw?
Lefty.
And what was your strong point in pitching as far as
Well, David, I look back and think about these things a lot now. That's all history. But I always could throw pretty well, and sometime between my junior and senior years in high school, I got stronger, and when the senior year opened, I opened with a no-hit game against another suburb, Fayetteville, and struck out 18 of 21, and I could throw hard after that. And being left-handed, for some reason, your ball seemed to move pretty well. And
okay. Now, you were in the military service?
Yeah, I was in for 42 months. Served for a year in Germany, but was never shot at in anger.
Right. And you went to Syracuse University?
I did. Yeah, I would have been class of 44, but because of military service, I graduated in January of 47, got credit for some of my officer training, and was able to get through a semester ahead of time.
Now, how did you get involved with organized baseball? A scout see you?
Well, when I was pitching at North Syracuse High School, we won the county championship. I pitched a couple of no-hitters, and one of the bird dogs for the Yankees began following me. And then I think the turning point was when we had freshman teams and varsity teams then in college. And I pitched a two-hitter down at Cornell, shut them out. And the fellow who was general manager of the Binghamton Triplets, the Yankee Farm, was up there to look me over, and I pitched very well that day. So after that, the next year, the Yankees offered me some money with an agreement, which I later learned was offered me a few $100 to sign an agreement to join the Yankee Farm System upon graduation. Now that was illegal, but I didn't know that.
Now, your first year in organized baseball was with Norfolk.
That's correct. I came back from overseas, and the Yankees offered me 2 places, either Binghamton in the Class A Eastern League or Norfolk in the Class B Piedmont League. Well, as it happened, my wife-to-be, whom I'd met in Asheville, North Carolina, doing service, had moved with that particular unit as to Newport News. I can't remember the organization. Well, the choice was easy. I went to Norfolk and won. I don't know what the record shows me, and I can't remember.
5-1.
What? Pardon?
5-1.
Five and one. Okay. Now, that may not include the playoff when I won two games, and my wife and I were due to be married on September 21st, 1946, in Asheville, North Carolina, and my wife was wondering whether I was delaying the marriage because I won two games, including at least one against Roanoke, which was a first place team. But I got to the church on time. And incidentally, something I'm real proud of, in all of the Yankee farm system, which was quite vast at that time, I was jumped all the way to the Yankees in spring training the following year. And I look at that, it tells me I must have had something right, because several of the scouts were very high on me, and I ended up at spring training with the Yankees, and a contract for a splendid $500 a month. Went to spring training with them, and then was farmed out to Newark come regular season time.
Now, with Norfolk, were you basically a starting pitcher?
Yes. Yeah, I never did much relief pitching.
Okay. And of course, Newark was AAA in 47?
No, AAA was the Piedmont League, was Class B, Baker.
Yeah, but Newark.
Newark was AAA, right. AAA. The Yankees had two farm clubs, AAA, Newark and Kansas City.
And in Newark, you were 6-10 that year.
6-10, and I will maintain to my dying day that I was better than that. I went, I think I lost my first four or five games. I remember the opener against Toronto, and the other pitcher was Luke Hot Potato Hamlin, who'd been in the big leagues quite a bit. And he beat me 3-2, and it seemed like every game I could come close, but I couldn't win it. And I think I was on the brink of being shipped down to Binghamton. George Selkirk was our manager, and lo and behold, they called on me to pitch an exhibition game in Newark against the Yankees, and I had 2 days rest. I recall that. I came to the ballpark.
This was during the season?
Of 1947.
During the season.
I had no suspicion that I was going to pitch against the Yankees, and so they had somebody to throw to the Wolves, and they threw me, and I pitched a four-hitter. And beat them, my memory is, something like 4-2. So that was another turning point. In baseball, when you're trying to get started, you usually have several turning points, and that certainly was one of them. And I remember that very well.
Who were some of your teammates on that Newark team?
Okay, Sherman Lawler, the catcher. Bud Metheny, M-E-T-H-E-N-Y, who'd been up with the Yankees doing the war. We had several, this was a time for baseball to adjust to the fact that so many fellows were coming back from military service. Matheny had stayed out of service and played right field, but he was like a couple of others, Johnny Lucadello. He was a wartime big league player, but come peacetime, they were AAA players. Jack Phillips, Jerry Coleman, who went up to the Yankees, and then Gene Woodland, who had, was my roommate and a marvelous ball player. Lou Novikov was with us for a while.
See, when they called the Mad Russian?
The Mad Russian, indeed. He was a delightful fellow. And we had some other guys who were not much, but they were still trying to reorganize the system now that all these fellows were coming back.
About any pitchers on that team?
Our best pitcher was an old-timer named Herb Karpel, K-A-R-P-E-L. He was round as a butterball, and he couldn't throw hard, but he got them out, and just watching him, you learned an awful lot about changing speeds, that kind of thing.
Right.
Oh, I might mention, our first manager that year was George Selkirk, old Twinkle Toes, who replaced Babe Ruth, and he was a disaster because his idea of baseball was get up there and you get a hit and the next guy would get a hit because he was used to playing with the Yankees. They replaced him in mid-season with Bill Skiff, S-K-I-F-F, who was the super scout of the Yankees and a very fine manager. and we were glad to have him.
What were your remember what your salary was in that year?
My salary that year, I had a big league contract, and I was optioned out from the parent club, the Yankees. It was a glorious $500. And I'm not doing this very chronologically, David, but the following year, I went up to $600.
Per month.
And I'd made 150 at Norfolk. But you see these kinds of things. Looking back at baseball, there were some real scoundrels there. They would mail you the contract at the very latest date they could under the regulations. So come 48, I get this contract from George Weiss about 3 days before the deadline, saying we're going to pay you $600. Well, you don't have time to protest because you want to report on time to spring training. So I went to spring training at St. Petersburg. That was the year that Bucky Harris was manager, and then I went a second time with the Yankees. That was Stengel's first year. That's a story unto itself.
We'll get to that.
But here's what I'm saying about the scoundrels, where I'm not sympathetic to owners very often, to many of them, I should say. You go down there at $600, and you've got to be there, or you lose your chance to make an impression. And that was, I think, the first or second year that they gave you $25 expense account. Well, I was so poor that I borrowed from the church mice, but had been in service for 3.5 years. Took my wife down. We had a little apartment not far from Miller Huggins Field in St. Petersburg. And one day, Red Patterson, who was a former newspaper man and was assistant to Weiss, came out on the ball field and he said, "Mr. Weiss said, if you don't sign that contract," I hadn't signed, I had just appeared, "we're going to cancel your $25 a week." Well, I couldn't have stood for that, so I signed the contract. But that was the kind of shenanigans that they pulled on you. And when you see how they tried to shortchange Joe DiMaggio, for example, over the years, you don't have much sympathy for people like George Weiss and a number of the others.
Okay. Now, in 1948, you went to Kansas City.
Kansas City, right.
Now,
the manager there was Dick Bartell, Rowdy Richard.
The Giants.
And there's a marvelous picture of a pile of baseball players out on the field, a fight. And Bartell was at the bottom because he'd started. He was quite a fellow.
And was that the first time you've been to that part of the country?
Yeah, except passing through in the military. I had served domestically in the military. It was a month in Detroit. I was Hamilton Field, just outside San Francisco. Thought I was headed for Japan, but it didn't turn out that way. I ended up in Europe.
Now, Kansas City, you had a 7-3 record that year. You were with them the whole
year? I guess, okay, I can't be sure whether it was 7-3 or 7-5, but I'll accept the 7-3.
Right. And who were some of your teammates on that?
All right, that was a good ball club, except for the pitchers, including me, because I was running into arm trouble. And I can go back to this later, because as I hearken back to my baseball days, you see several turning points and where things might have gone this way or that. Hank Bauer, Al Rosen, who was there on an arrangement. He didn't belong to the Yankees, but there's been some sort of a deal that he was going to play there that year. Harry Kraft was an outfielder, but Harry Kraft had broken his leg or ankle and couldn't play. Those were the real good ones on the club. Oh, Ralph Houk, who was a catcher. A marvelous competitor and a great catcher. I've never pitched to a catcher I like better than Houk.
Then later that year, you went back to Newark.
Went back to Newark. One of the crazies that happened. It looked as though Newark was going to make the playoffs and start off against Rochester, which was heavily laden with left-handers.
With Rochester, was that a Cardinal?
That's correct.
At that time?
And so they shipped me over to be a left-hander to face Rochester in the playoffs. Well, I got to Newark, and we never made the playoffs, or we did, never played Rochester anyway. So I think I was 2-2.
Right.
2-2. Yeah.
Okay. Now, 1949, you went down to spring training with the Yankees again?
No, I didn't. I went to the Yankees only twice, once under Yankee contract. Second year under Newark contract, but they bring in some extra pitchers. And I've got an anecdote or two of that if you want it.
Go right ahead.
Huh?
Go right ahead.
Well, I just, in 49, I went down
Kansas City, started
with Kansas City. Kansas City, yeah. And that was a tempestuous year because I was having terrible arm trouble. And I can go back and pick up that thread. But I was with Kansas City and having in and out. Some days I just couldn't throw the ball. And they sold me to Memphis for Pat Seary. Pat Seary was the outfielder who once hit 4 home runs in
right.
one game. Well, I don't know whether it was extremely warm weather or what, but I got to Memphis and I pitched very well, regardless of what the record may show, because we were a miserable ball team. The only fellow I can remember you might recognize was Hugh Mulcahy.
Oh, yeah, the old Philly pitcher.
Sinker ball pitcher.
Lost a lot of games, too.
Yeah, losing pitcher Mulcahy, right. But he was a good pitcher, had a great sinker ball, and was a very intelligent fellow. Our manager was Al, who caught for the Pittsburgh paper out team.
Lopez?
I'll think of it.
Al Lopez?
No, not Lopez. Lopez managed Indianapolis in the league when I was with Kansas City. I'll think of him. But I pitched very well. And I remember Nashville was running away with the league, and we played Nashville in Nashville, which had that famous ballpark, Sulphur Dell, and the right field was short, and they hit a goat path up there. And the right fielder, who was Babe Barna at the time, could patrol that goat path, and everything else went for bases. So I beat him and broke. They had a long winning streak at home, 16 or 17 games, and I beat him. And I remember, gee, why I can't think of our manager. Al was a catcher. He used to officiate basketball. He says, "Hey, kid, you got a major league fastball." I know that when I'm right. And I must have pitched well because Sacramento bought me. And I went out there. And,
now, who were they affiliated with?
Right, Sacramento was unaffiliated.
Right.
And, I've got a blank spot. A wonderful manager there, too. And I pitched well there. I think it was something like 7-5. Does that show on your record?
7-5, exactly,
yeah.
Right.
But when it came playoff time, I was the money pitcher and always started the series. And I pitched quite well. I can only remember one bad game against Seattle. And against Hollywood, which won the pennant, and Fred Haney was the manager. And they were Brooklyn affiliated. And I pitched very well against them. So Haney liked what he saw. And that winter, Branch Rickey back in Brooklyn started talking about he had a sleeper that he was going to bring in. And the sleeper, he didn't, what he was thinking about, he needed left-handed pitching because if you've been in the old Brooklyn ballpark, you had that wall out there, 296 feet, and beyond it was Bedford Avenue. So one snowbound winter month, maybe in January, up in Syracuse, I pick up the Syracuse Herald Journal, and there's a 60-point headline, Mullett drafted by Dodgers, or bought by, drafted, I think, by the Dodgers. I was a sleeper. And so I was to go down to spring training. And am I getting out of the sequence you want?
No, it's okay. It's fine.
Okay. When I went to spring training, I was hopeful my arm trouble had gone away, but it hadn't, of course. I remember Bert Schotten greeted me at the door of the clubhouse, which is an old military barracks at Vero Beach. because he thought I was the left-hander they needed to fill out a thin staff, and I was hopeful I was too. But when I started throwing the first day or two, I couldn't even finish batting practice. So every morning for the rest of spring training, I went over to the dispensary and they injected into my arm, which was not the most pleasant experience I've ever had, trying what they determined. There was calcium at the head of the bone there. So we start north, and I remember, this may be appropriate or maybe inappropriate, John Padres was my roommate with the class, with the Brooklyn B Club. They had an A Club doing exhibitions, and you know, you jump north by so many mile increments, and we went through Mobile. And John and I shared a compartment, and we played in Mobile, and it was a crowd. They had them standing all over the outfield and so forth. And I ended up following Joe Black as a relief pitcher in about the 14th inning or so. It was a long ball game, and night was falling, and there was a big catcher named St. Clair, Ebba St. Clair. He hit the ball into the crowd for a ground rule double, and I'm the losing pitcher. So we go out, as ball players do. We're not going to start the train for our next stop until midnight or something. So we went out to eat, and then you go to a movie, and then you pick up a paper and go back to your Pullman car. And I had the upper berth, and John had the lower. And suddenly he had the craziest laugh I ever heard. He and I were later to play together at Montreal. He was, I used to call him the lazy Lithuanian. His father was an iron miner up above Albany, New York. And I said, John, what are you laughing at? He said, look at this. So it said, Mal Millett, the second of two Negro relief pitchers. And it was getting dark, and I tanned very easily, and I had a good tan. So the sports writer thought that I was Negro also. The funny part of it was, the previous winter, I had a journalism degree out of Syracuse, and I had started working on the Asheville paper in the off season. So I'm a journalist. At that time, in Alabama, it was libel per se, automatic libel, for a white person to be depicted as a black. So I had a per se winnable suit against the newspaper if I wanted to file it. Well, of course I didn't. I would have been the supreme hypocrite if I had filed, and I'm in the newspaper profession myself, and I never was in agreement with that approach anyway, by any means. So anyway, when I went north, we were opening the season against the Whiz Kids of Philadelphia, an old Scheib Park, is that right, Scheib? Yeah. And Mr. Rickey was sitting at the railing right close up watching us practice. And I was selected to pitch batting practice, and God, I was hurting. And so Mr. Rickey called me over, and when I finished, he said, son, I remember that was his first word, son. He said, does your arm hurt you that much? I said, it sure does. So on May 16th, with him footing the bill, I was in Baltimore and had surgery.
Johns Hopkins?
Pardon?
At Johns Hopkins?
It was part of Johns Hopkins, but it seemed to me the building itself was Union Memorial. But the surgeon was the one who operated on DiMaggio's heel, George Bennett, who was considered the best in the business. And so they operated, and they took out a little piece of calcium that was right at the head of the humerus, which they're all now, they use every time pitcher gets a shoulder injury. They call it, I'll think of it. But what I remember was it was at the head of the supraspinatus muscle, and it's part of that group that formed the shoulder muscle. And for a while I carried it around a little jar of alcohol, a little piece of calcium they took off the shoulder. So I went back, and after I don't know how many weeks of recovery, pitched batting practice, and then Ricky called me into his office, and he said, Millett, he said, we got to get you in shape now that you can throw again. He said, let's see, where would you like to go? I said, well, Montreal or St. Paul or Hollywood. Those were the three AAA clubs they had. So first he said, I said, well, Montreal will be fine. He said, well, that's okay. And then he had these great eyebrows, and he was a great actor. Oh, he says, no, he says, Clay Hopper is the manager up there, and he said, it looks as though they got a chance to win the pennant, and I don't want you to get in the ball game, but what, you have a sore arm, the first pitch, you want to walk off that mound, you do it. The game would not be that important. He said, no, not Montreal. I said, what about St. Paul? So he went through that same routine again. Oh, he said, no, 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 no. He said, St. Paul under Walter Alston. Am I right on that? Yeah, I think we're right. Is beginning to move a little bit, and you might be in a pressure situation and hurt your arm. So we went through the same routine with Hollywood, and then suddenly, as if inspiration had struck him, he said, I know where. He said, Elmira, Class B, Eastern League. He said, George Fallon is the manager, and they're in seventh place. He said, you can do what you want to. So that night, Ricky was flying to Montreal to take a look at Carl Erskine. And then he was going to go to Elmira, as it turned out. So I said, Millett, come along. So I go back to the St. George Hotel, grab my belongings. My wife is 8 months pregnant down in Nashville. And I go on the plane out of old Floyd Bennett Field up to Montreal. We get there. Ricky was out of the car by the time it stopped to see Erskine, who was pitching at the old Montreal ballpark on Delormier Downs, they called it. Erskine pitched a two-hitter, and resultingly was called up to the Dodgers and helped them greatly. But the next day we go on to Elmira, which means that 24 hours after I got the word, I was in an Elmira uniform. So I got to know the sports writer on the Elmira morning paper, the Star Gazette, and his name was Bob Morse. And he said one day, he said, Mal, he said, how come you're so darn long getting here after they announced, after we learned you were coming here? I said, Bob, I was here the next day. He said, oh, he said, Ricky told us about it a week ago. So you can see what a conniver he was, but a brilliant man. And that's, I liked him very much.
Now you mentioned you flew up with Ricky to Montreal. When you traveled regularly, were they using planes then, or are you still using trains?
Well, that was Ricky's own plane to do what he wanted to with him. But at that time, in AAA and much of the time in the big leagues, by train, go to Boston or to Philadelphia, certainly. And there may have been a plane flight or two, but I was not on it. It was an old DC-7, I guess it was, from World War II. But all the time I was in AAA, except for some from Sacramento, we would fly to San Diego or to Los Angeles. But in the American Association, we went by train.
Now, you were at Elmira for a period, and then you went on to the big league.
Okay, now at Elmira I pitched very well. I think I was 7-1, although my cousin was 7-1, and I pitched very well. And I went up to the Dodgers, and the season, it's after they're allowed to expand the roster, and I got in two games.
That's
my big league career.
This was around September then?
Yeah, it had to be September, yeah. But
now your first game, where was that?
The first game was, there was a day-night doubleheader in Dodgers Stadium, Ebbets Field, with the New York Giants. Play the afternoon game, you go in, take a shower, eat some sandwiches for supper, and then you go out, play the night game. So it was on about 11:30 at night, and we're battling the Dodgers or the Giants in extra innings, I think it was, or certainly late innings, and I'm called in as a relief pitcher. And I pitched one inning or something like that, and I had two strikeouts. I was very proud of that. But one of them was against the other pitcher, Dave Coslow. And I felt pretty good about that. And so that was that. Then later, I was called in against the old Boston Braves. Now, Eleanor, come say hello to Dave Carlson. My wife, Eleanor.
Hi, hello.
From Newport, right?
Pardon?
From Newport News?
Asheville. Now,
David, but I worked at Langlandsville, and so I thought, well, did I know you there?
David is a retired pharmacist. Let's see if you know what that is.
Well, now don't. They change colors and pills.
Yeah.
It's a common
thing. An iron pill.
An iron pill. Because of the fact, please sit down, and because of the fact that my kids are going to Boston, I think I walked a man. I think that's right. Anyway, the next hitter is the right. No, the next hitter, I don't remember who it was, but he hit a ground ball right at Reese, and damnation if it didn't bounce over his head, because it was a double play ball. And I thought, gee, I didn't need this like a hole in the head. And the next hitter then was Bob Elliott, the old third baseman, a right-handed hitter, and all I knew about him was he stood way back in the box, but he was an outside ball hitter. So I was wondering, how in the world am I going to pitch this guy? And out comes Bert Schotten, and he waves me off and brings in Don Newcomb. And Newcomb, about the third pitch, got a double play ball from Elliott, and the inning was over, as was my major league career. We lost that. That's why we lost to the Phillies on the last game of the season, when Dick Sisler hit an opposite field home run, and Newcomb lost to Robin Roberts. That was a great ball game. So 1 minute I thought I was going to be at least around for a World Series when Richie Ashburn, who didn't have much of an arm, threw out Cal Abrams, our runner at the plate, and it was all over. Am I too detailed?
No, it's great.
But your questions bring back memories which are are latent most of the time. But when I get with a baseball fellow like you, it brings back a lot of memories.
No, that's fine. Now, on that Dodger team, of course, there was some great players, Hall of Famers, Jackie Robinson.
Sure.
What was your, in other words, what was your impression of some of the players?
My impression was very good. Campanella, the catcher. Marvelous. Gil Hodges, the first baseman, marvelous. Robinson, the second baseman, the nonpareil. Reese, the shortstop, just magnificent. Billy Cox, the third baseman. If there was ever a better fielder than Cox, he must have been something. He had quick hands. Great person. Andy Papko, left field, had come over from Chicago in some kind of a trade. Duke Snyder in center field, and Carl Farrillo in right field. Farrillo with I never saw Clemente, but if he had a better arm than Carl Farrillo, he must have been something. And as far as outfielding ability is concerned, Duke Snyder must have been one of the best. He had that. Center field was very constricted, but he could go get him. On pitching, that's where they didn't have all they needed. And the reason I was bought, I guess, Newcomb was number one. Preacher Rowe was excellent and a wonderful character from Ash Flat, Arkansas. And I palled around with him, lived with him down in Florida in spring training, along with another catcher named Clarence Podbelian, B-O-D-B-E-L-I-A-N. But by watching Rowe, when my arm gave me trouble, I learned so much. And that was, I'm diverging, I know.
Okay.
But up in Montreal with a good ball club, a good manager, we won the pennant 2 years in a row, won the playoffs in 1951. And I was 10-2, and I had the best earned run average in the league.
2.30.
Was it? Oh, you got, I can't lie much, can I? But I fell three or four innings short of the minimum to have the league earned run average championship. The next year I go 13-2, and I'll get back to the Brooklyn roster here in a minute. 13-2, so it meant that over 2 years I won 23 and lost 4. I think that's right.
Right.
But I pitched extremely well. But I had a good defensive team behind me. Bobby Morgan was the shortstop. Jim Gilliam, the second baseman, as a case in point. And Don Thompson was the center fielder 1 year. But I better get back to Montreal in a minute here. I was coming up on 30 years old. You know, I had a baseball age of 29. But in those years, all right, you had 3 years in college, 3.5 years in the military, and then you start into baseball, and suddenly you turn around and you're 29 baseball, or actual 30 years old. But getting back to Brooklyn, this is not sequential, I'll tell you. The pitchers were Newcomb, I mentioned, Carl Erskine, and Preacher Rowe. And Preacher was a master, and I learned so much from him that helped me when I went to Montreal, because I would have days up there when I couldn't pitch hard. Arm just wouldn't get loose. And my fastball was never the same after that surgery anyway, except rarely. And I thought, oh boy, I'm coming back, but then the next time out, no. But he was a master. And I learned to change pace, and I learned to throw a slider and change speeds. But other pitchers, Ralph Branca, who threw the home run ball, of course. Clyde King, who went on to manage. Did he manage the Yankees 1 year briefly? And Rex Barney, the Wild Man. And those were the main ones.
Was Joe Black still with them?
Pardon?
Joe Black was...
Joe Black came up the next year because Joe Black was a pitcher at Montreal the first year I was there, and he was a secondary pitcher for us. But when I say secondary, that is not that uncomplimentary, because with a farm club like Montreal, you've got all the prospects there. And so we had two or three fellows who looked like as if they would develop, but they didn't. But when you start, you maybe get to start every 6 days or so, because they had to look at the other guys. We had a pitcher named Hampton Coleman, University of North Carolina fellow, who had a marvelous curveball and was on the fringe of becoming a big leaguer when he got in a car accident. John Padres was there. Tommy Lasorda, who hasn't changed a bit. He was noisy and nonstop talker then, and he is now. But nobody loved baseball more than Tommy. So the Brooklyn Club was good, but Black came on the next year to become a good reliever. But it didn't have a good relief pitcher, and it was up near the top, but they needed just that little extra something to really take off. But Brooklyn was a marvelous place to play. The stadium was something like 32,000, that sounds right.
Right.
And the New York writers, the coverage was tremendous.
How about the fans? Were the fans different than other fans in other cities?
Well, I can't compare, except that I think baseball was a religion in Brooklyn. It was Brooklyn's only claim to fame, and there was so much negative talk about Brooklyn and so forth. But gee, it was a marvelous place to play. And you had the symphony, the Brooklyn Symphony, which would go up and play these tunes in the last row of the grandstand. You had the lady who played the organ. I should be able to remember her name. And she always came up with the appropriate tune under the circumstances. And it was marvelous, yeah.
Okay, now, so you're getting close to 30 years old, but in that second year, after that second year with Montreal.
Okay.
What did you
All right, now, I'm 30 years old. I got a journalism degree. I was magna cum laude out of Syracuse. I could write, did a lot of writing. I ghost wrote a number of articles for colonels and generals in World War II at one time. I should say colonel, never a general.
Did you do any for baseball players?
Sir?
Did you do any for baseball players?
Like No, I didn't. It was the military, and I was had gone to officers training school, 6 weeks of which were at Yale, trying to learn how the high tech worked. And I was surrounded by engineers and radio repairmen, and poor Mal was struggling just to get through. And once you get out into the real army, it was the sergeants who did all the work and all knew what they were doing. I didn't. But I remember this, David, anecdote. After I had revealed that I intended to quit after 1952, they had two or three French language newspapers at that time in Montreal, probably still had. And I remember sitting on the equipment truck in the clubhouse one day, and here's this little French writer, and he spoke in French usually, but he was speaking English to me. He said, "Millet, why you quit? Why you quit?" with a heavy accent. And I said to him, the wonderful little guy, and I said, I didn't want to become a baseball bum and pass up years when I could develop a newspaper career. And I remember being with the Yankees in 47 or 48, and at 10 o'clock in the morning, we had two-a-day practices. Who shows up in the dugout drunk as a skunk but Jimmy Fox, who was one of my idols over the years. And this told me, here's the guy who's having a very tough time adjusting to life after baseball. And it wasn't far from that time when the old Yankee right fielder, Powell, committed suicide. And he too was having a tough time facing life when he didn't have a baseball uniform on. And then I just said to myself, okay, you got a good education, you're confident you can do well in another field, except I managed in all my career to be in low-paying jobs, certainly in baseball, and for a long while in newspapers.
What was your major league salary?
The year I was with Brooklyn, I made $6,000. They had recently put in a very forward step. Any major league player had to make at least $5,000. So when I was sent to the operation, and I guess they had me under an option arrangement at that time, I thought, uh-oh, Branch Rickey, who's known for his parsimony, is going to cut me to $5,000, but he never did. So I always had a spot in my heart for Branch Rickey. Gee, look at this. It's crazy. I'm just going to rest this leg a bit.
Sure.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so after baseball, then you went into the newspaper business?
Yeah. That I told you that story about Mobile, Alabama, and the second of... I had worked the previous year in the off-season, and the sports staff of the Asheville Times, the afternoon paper. And when I went back, I was there a year, and then I went over... I was 2 years, and I was made sports editor of the morning paper, which is the larger paper. And then from there, after 3 years or 4 years, I was offered a chance to become sports director over both papers at Winston-Salem, and took that job. And then 3 years after I got there, they made me managing editor. So I could write and I could edit, and got along fine.
And then,
yeah.
Not bothering you to move the car.
Yeah. David, I thought of two names I couldn't think of earlier in case you want to still get. The manager at Sacramento, Pacific Coast League, was Del Baker, who is well known as a coach, and why nobody ever hired him as a major league manager, I'll never know. He was bright and he could handle it. Who earlier was Al Todd, T-O-D-D. And I... And I remember him so well because he said he got to be about 36 or 37 before he really learned all there was to know about hitting. But he said, about the time I knew that, I was too old to catch. And that stuck in my mind forever. Back to my post-baseball career, I had been manager of the Winston-Salem papers for 7 years when I was invited to join the staff of the American Press Institute at Columbia University in New York City. It was the national training center for the United States and Canada for newspapers of people of all stripes, from reporters to publishers, and we would hold seminars there, and that was great fun. I got to know, I could walk into almost any newspaper in the country and know somebody there because I had worked with them. And I was there 1966 to 1974, 8 years, when Columbia, which in its salad days had taken on a number of institutes which weren't part of their academic program but supplemented it, just had to have more space, and they chased away two or three institutes, and we could see that they would never give us more space than we needed in the journalism building. So after a search and a lot of fundraising, we came down to Reston, which was just getting started, and the American Newspaper Publishers Association was already here. And so I came with them, and it's been a happy 24 years there. But when came time for the 50th anniversary of ANPA, wrote a book on the history of it, and I remember titling the one chapter From Broadway to the Boondocks, because they were the Boondocks then. But now you see what's happening. It looks almost like a Manhattan skyline in some place. So one thing I wanted to add as baseball player, my particular career was made less by some arm problems and so forth, but I loved to play baseball. And there was nothing better than to be pitching a ball game in which you think you're going right, and nothing worse than when you're pitching and you can't do the things you'd like to do.
How did you get along with the umpires?
I got along with the umpires very well. I noted with sadness the other day, or with happiness rather, that Nestor Shylock had been named to the Hall of Fame, and I pitched with him in the games several times. One thing, I got along with them okay. Most of us did. We'd carp and holler and so forth, but when you had a good one like Shylock, you knew he was a good one. I might mention one thing I skipped. I played winter baseball in Cuba 1 year. And Mike Guerra, G-U-E-R-R-A, was the manager. And that was quite an experience. But you could make $1,000 a month down there in the wintertime. And I hurt my back sometime in late February or something. and it just needed rest. So they let me go at some point. But several days before I was to head home, we added a new outfielder to the team. And I should back up and say, the owners of these teams were the most tempestuous souls you ever saw in your life. And if you'd lose the ball game, four or five of them would come streaming into the clubhouse, closet with the manager, what changes they could make in the roster. Well, sometimes there's a lot of sound and fury and no action, but they were firebrand. But anyway, they were going to add a new player who arrived maybe a week or 10 days before I got there. And in comes this fellow, and it turned out to be Willie Mays, who had hit 400 or something like that for Trenton in the Interstate League that year. But on his way down, he stopped in his old hometown, which I think was Birmingham, pick up basketball, and he sprained the living daylights out of an ankle. So his ankle was like that. He was there, but he couldn't play in the days that I was there. So here I was on the same team with him, but never saw him play there. But he wasn't a big fellow, really, by baseball standards. But one of my dear friends, Don Thompson, was playing winter ball. And he said when he got good enough, he started taking batting practice. And he was driving the ball to the moon. Don thought, who in the world is this guy? And of course, he turned out to be one of the greatest players of all time. But I often regretted that I never got a chance to play with. I did, as I say, pitch against the Yankees in that exhibition game, so I did get to pitch twice to DiMaggio that day. I got him out on a line drive to the shortstop and a one-hopper back to me, and I'll remember those if I live to be 100. I don't think Yogan played in that game. I think one of their sub-catchers, maybe Charlie Silvera. But these things are pretty indelible in your mind, you know, because when DiMaggio walks up to the plate, you wonder, well, where do we go from here? But I got him out.
Do you keep in touch with any ex-players or former teammates?
Say that loud.
Do you keep in touch with any of the ex?
Yeah, not many. It's hard to do. I'll tell you another anecdote, if you can stand it. Hampton Coleman, whom I mentioned, was one of my dear friends, and his wife died recently, and we called him and wrote him. Don Thompson was my roommate, who was an outfielder for Brooklyn, used mainly in defensive situations, because he was a glorious outfielder. If the strike zone that exists today had existed then, I think Don could have hit 310, 315, because he was a great low ball hitter, but the fastball up here, he hit fly balls to the outfield or something. And that's one of the things I hate to see happen in baseball, is the way the strike zone has migrated down to the ankles and ends at the waist. It changes the game quite severely for various players, and especially pitchers, I guess. Others that I've been in touch with been few and in between. Have to think about it. But there's one exception to this. Baseball supposedly began in 1839. It had to be 1989. I was 2 years retired because I was 67 and just doing some retirement consulting and so forth. When they're going to have a full 9-inning game at Cooperstown between the two leagues to celebrate 50 years. And the manager of one team was, American League, was to be Bob Feller. And, National League, come on, Mal. The left-hander won 300 and some games.
Warren Spahn?
Pardon?
Warren Spahn?
Warren Spahn, of course. So they're picking the rosters. And the sponsors, which were an insurance company or something, a conglomerate, were picking, and they invited me to go to Cooperstown to play in this game. I thought, oh, Lord. Well, what I quickly analyzed was they knew I was in the newspaper business. I'd done quite a bit of freelance writing, and including an article now and then for the Washington Post. So they invited me, and I could see the method in their madness that they were hoping I could add to the publicity of it. Well, the only way I could, after the game, I wrote a piece that about my experiences there that the Post gave good display to, and all my old newspaper friends razzed me about. But I went up there, and the rosters were something. Spahn and Feller, but Bob Gibson. On the National League team, and we won something like 8-4.
Was it a 4-9 inning game?
Yeah. The victories, major league victories on the pitching staff of the National League, led of course by Spahn, who was 70 then, was something like 1,310 career victories, of which none were mine. And so we're having.
Did you pitch in the game?
Yeah. They came, had a cocktail party the night before, and a get together, and Gibson and who was the base dealer? Lou
Brock.
Brock. They had the microphone and so forth. And just the usual kind of chit chat. But Spahn said, Millette, I don't know if I'll be able to use you or not. My guys want to win. Well, we started off, Robin Roberts was our first pitcher, and then Gibson, and as they went down the line, things changed, and eventually Spahn pitched, I think, the last inning, and his balls were any over, like he used to throw over the house, because, and Feller was the same way. And I thought to myself afterward, I'll backtrack here a bit, as he worried about who's going to win in the way Feller and Spahn threw, the score would have been 20-20 if they pitched the whole game. But it was good to see him. And there was a golf match the next day, and I got to talk to Spahn quite a bit. But two things. Anyway, about the fifth or sixth inning, I thought, Lord, I'm not going to see. Gibson had pitched, Roberts had started, and then who was the kid, Jim? I'll think of it. We were leading, and we won on a home run by the old Yankee player whose son is now with Seattle. Who am I thinking of? Did a lot of home runs. We won something like 6 or 8-2. But suddenly Gibson said, Millette, you want to pitch? I said, yeah. So I said, get ready. It was already starting an inning. So I go down to the outfield, and I'm throwing as fast as I can hit the ball back again. And they called me in. And the catcher was a fellow who caught for the Mets in their glory days. And I loved the way he set up. And believe it or not, I think I must have thrown about 12, 14 pitches. And every damn one was a strike. So I got one guy out, can't tell you who, but the second guy hit a high fly ball about 10 steps behind second base, and our second baseman was Bill Mazeroski, who was one of the great fielders of all time. He circled around that thing like that, and finally it went down behind his head, and I hope it was scored as an error, but no matter. So the next guy up, whoever it was, hit a ground ball to the infield, and I had a double play, and I was out of it. But I gloried in the fact that I got the pitch in that ball game, and I took a terrible razzing because I had the old Brooklyn Dodger uniform and the heavy flannel. And Feller came over in the locker room, oh yeah, that's such and such an ounce of flannel. And all the other guys had their modern uniforms because they were much more recent, or someone like Spahn or Feller. Well, I think Cleveland worked with the team. They had their modern uniform. So the Dodgers were a great outfit. I wrote and told them that I was the only Dodger represented on the 50th anniversary team, but I sure as hell took a lot of kidding about that uniform. So in the mail a few days later comes a modern Brooklyn uniform, and I've got packed away downstairs somewhere. And I thought that was a pretty good bunch of people to do that kind of thing. But that was some contacts with a number of good players. Gee.
Did you play any other old-timer games?
No, no, never was invited. But you know, that was a small industry, because I remember a couple of players saying, well, we'll see you in Anaheim in a couple of weeks. They were invited to that. But that was the kind of thing that I feared a person could do if he hung around baseball too much without a career of his own. You know, they end up selling used cars and playing an all-time, all-star game. That overstates the case. But that, back in the days when they made so little money as I did, you thought about those things. So today, believe it or not, I find baseball boring if I can't see what the pitcher and the hitter are doing. In other words, if you're a television cameraman and you've got a good angle toward the plate, I watch every pitch carefully. But if the camera's off to the side, that changes it greatly for me. I'd gone to a convention in Hawaii for my work, and coming back, we have a son who lives south of Los Angeles, so we went to the ball game, and I was too dumb to call ahead and see if I could mooch him, pass it to him. We had good seats, about opposite first base, but you couldn't see except high and low. The pitcher pitching high, we were pitching low, and I enjoyed it up to a point. But I could see that I wouldn't become a real baseball fan unless I had good seats. And Lasorda was the manager, and I sent my name down and got down to see him. And he had a picture of the old Montreal team up on the wall next to Frank Sinatra. And Tommy was the right guy in the right place for many years. So that... I still follow baseball, but I've never been up to the new Orioles Stadium. Just too far to go, and too late at night. And you know, I've been there in the old stadium, pitched an old Memorial Stadium, and even the one before that. I guess that's what I have to say. Let's ask some questions.
Just one more. Baseball today is when you play. What are the main differences other than the salary?
Now, salary is certainly one of them, but there are a number of other changes, too. First of all, a lot of those players go into the big leagues without the benefit of the learning experience of playing more in the minor leagues, and a lot of them don't have the finesses that we had to learn of bunting and the hit and run and things like that. But at the same time, so many things have changed. Strength. When I was coming up, I was tall and skinny, and one of the things I was told is, don't lift weights, it'll make your muscle bound. And that was pretty much the understanding throughout baseball. So when I was at that game in Cooperstown, I asked Feller how come he, years ago, would lift weights. He had a suitcase in which he carried weights, and he'd do weightlifting in his hotel room, etc. And I said, why, when the word throughout baseball was don't lift, you lifted? He said, it always made good sense to me. So he was one of the rare exceptions to go against the rule, and maybe that was one of the reasons he could throw so doggone hard. Now everybody hits the weight room and does things like that. Secondarily, people are more transient. In spring training, the kids from California would come in and they were ready to go. They'd played ball all winter, pitchers especially. And a couple of pitchers would make tremendous impressions early because they were ready to throw, but then others would catch up with them. The Yankees one spring had a kid named Don Johnson, with whom I later played at Sacramento. He came in throwing hard, and there were all the write-ups about Don Johnson, but what it didn't tell, he never learned to throw a curve. Caught up with him, and he spent most of his career in AAA. Those were a couple of the things. Pay, of course, gee whiz. You know, some of these people make more in an inning than I made in my whole lifetime. But of course, television changed all that. But it was pretty sad. I read something the other day about the battles DiMaggio had, and he got up to $100,000. That was almost heresy that anybody should be paid that. And you remember Babe Russo quote about he was making more than the president. He said, I had a better year than
yeah.
I think it was Warren Harding had. So it's great. And but some of those folks, Ricky was ahead of his time. He, at Vero Beach, he had us doing some things that I never saw in the Yankee two spring trainings. I can't remember being taught anything in the two Yankee spring trainings, but they had the horses. They had these wonderful players. Now, some other things I mentioned, the strike zone has changed so greatly, and I think that's wrong. And then new pitches have come up. What used to be called a forkball, put the ball way back in here and throw it, and it was sort of a change of pace. Now I guess it's being held out farther, and Roger Craig was teaching even push that ball with a thumb as you throw it, and you get that marvelous fast sinker ball that some of them use. My hands never were that big, I doubt I could do it. Something else I thought of one day, pitchers. And then the year-round staying in shape, you can do that now. If you were from where I was in Syracuse, you'd go to the gymnasium and trot around the small track or throw a medicine ball back and forth a little bit. But now, so many of the people spend their winters in Florida or Arizona or California, and they stay in good shape the year-round. That's certainly a big one. I think it's a more intelligent game, but I'm not sure that it often shows up on the field, the hit and run, the bunting. The Oriole Park is a hitter's paradise. You can hit the ball out of there anyplace. The game has changed a lot.
You mentioned earlier something about Casey Stengel. Well, he's got to be at least one Casey Stengel story.
Casey Stengel was just a theatrical figure. My first year with the Yankees was Bucky Harris, who was a real gentleman and good sound manager, as far as I could tell. I'm sure he was. But the next year, they had brought in Stengel from the Pacific Coast League. And I remember the first meeting we had in the old clubhouse at Miller Huggins Field. Stengel was up there marching back and forth and striking poses and making jokes and had a certain way of speaking that used to fracture the English language and talk about this guy or that, and you had to figure, who is he talking about now? But a very magnetic character. Well, I remember one time a writer named John Grebinger, G-R-E-B-I-N-G-E-R, for the New York Times, and there was another fellow too who I should remember because we became friends, and he couldn't hear very well. So Stengel cooked up this situation that with the writers, he's going to call a press conference, and Grebinger wore a hearing aid, as I do and my wife does, but without the hearing aid, he was almost deaf. So Stengel got up there with all the writers around him and started mouthing words with no volume. In other words, just moving his lips. And the other writers were all in on the joke, and they would gesture and make believe they were answering questions back or asking just, and poor John Dreger couldn't hear a thing because there was nothing to hear. And they took out this hearing aid and looked at it and looked at it until finally everybody broke up in laughter. And that was one of the kind of things Stengel did. But then years later, the Yankees came through Winston-Salem for an exhibition game. And I went over, and Stengel was the manager, and I went over to the Robert E. Lee Hotel. All the big hotels in the South were called Robert E. Lee. And had breakfast with him, and I'm trying to think of the other writer on the Yankees. And had breakfast with him, and he recalled me, he said, whether he did or not, but the writer did, because he and I had been pretty good buddies. And he was just the same guy. You know, he didn't change. Just a magnetic character. How good a manager he is, I don't know. Because he had such a good ball club, he could just push a button and away they would go. And you remember how controversial his platooning was. He platooned players a lot. But he certainly was a colorful and character and did a lot of good for baseball with his caricature. Let me think about it. Who the hell is that other manager? Other baseball writer, I can't think of it. I can see his face. And the first year I went south with the Dodgers, I'm skipping now, they had somebody in mind to send down to cover spring training, and somebody got sick on the old Herald Tribune staff, so they sent down Roger Kahn. Well, Kahn was new as green grass. I was a rookie green grass, but Kahn learned that I'd worked on a newspaper the previous winter, and so he and I became pretty good friends. And later, when he became sports editor of the Saturday Evening Post, I thought I had him sold on an article on somebody, but he never did run it, and he paid me all my expenses plus a little honorarium. But Kahn went on to write The Boys of Summer, which is a real classic. I've got that downstairs, and I've also got the fellow who went The Glory of Their Times, does that sound right?
Yeah, right. Roger, is it Roger Angel or Angel or something like
that? Was it Angel who wrote that?
Or Lawrence Ritter, maybe? Lawrence Ritter?
I've never read those name. Books, I don't think Angel writes for the New Yorker and is also the fiction editor for the New Yorker. But I think it was this Lawrence something.
Ritter,
that's right. That's a marvelous book. And since then, others have...
You know, a book you might be interested in, I don't know if it's by this Doris Kearns Goodwin, Wait Till Next Year, about Brooklyn, when she grew up in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Doris Kearns?
Yeah.
I met her once when she came in to be a speaker at the American Press Institute. She's a very lovely lady, and just so down to earth and so bright. But I don't think I've read that book. She did one. Did she also do one on Eleanor Roosevelt? She may have.
She may have.
She's on public broadcasting quite a bit, but a very likable person. Wait till next year. I'll look for that.
Okay. Anything else? That's all I have.
Okay. There was something else that's changed in baseball that I wanted to mention, but I skipped. You had weight training was one. You had the strike zone was another. The pay was another. The new pitches.
And the year-round training.
Yeah.
Staying in shape.
But in the old days, one time, who was the famous spitball pitcher who was allowed to keep his spitball
at? Grimes, Burley Grimes.
Burley Grimes. Burley Stubblebeard Grimes. He was working with the Yankees in some capacity. He was something like 44 years old, and he pitched batting practice one day. So I think I was pitching that night, and I thought, I'm going to enjoy pitching against Burley Grimes. But the rascal was still very proud, and I don't know how stiff and sore he was the next day, but he was throwing hard and he was throwing that spitter. I didn't do very well in batting practice, but he chuckled. He must have been quite a pitcher. And that was memorable, I thought about that a lot. I guess that's pretty much it. But I guess, looking back, I did a dumb thing when I was in service. I was a second lieutenant, and I was flying a desk at a world headquarters that had been set up in Asheville, North Carolina. And the reason was there was no more office space in Washington. So they rented the city hall in Asheville, which was deeply in debt. And I was assigned there. I was in San Francisco at Hamilton Field when suddenly I get orders to report to Asheville, North Carolina. Well, they had gone through this IBM punch card and saw I had a journalism degree or would have one, and they sent me in there to be assistant historical officer for the worldwide communications network with the Air Transport Command. And I got there and I arrived and they said, we don't need an assistant, we've got a fellow who's our historian. But anyway, I got to pitch in some semi-pro games and out at the big military medical hospital just outside of town, had a good baseball team, and they had three major leaguers there: Spud Chandler, Ron Northey, and Ray Mueller. And Mueller was a catcher with Cincinnati, Northey was an outfielder with Philadelphia, and Chandler with New York. So when I went out there and pitched a game against him with some local pickup team, and Chandler came over and said, you've been in contact with any major league players? Well, I didn't know quite how to answer, and I think I dissimulated with him. I said, well, the Yankees have talked to me some. Actually, I had signed that illegal agreement and didn't know it was illegal, which was unfortunate because just after that came the era of the bonus babies, where somebody signed for $20,000 and the Newark Club was full of them. And I said, well, I've been talking with them. He said, well, I'm going to let them know about you. And then that collapsed, and I didn't pitch a ball game or anything for weeks. And then somebody conjured up to have a charity game in Asheville between a pickup team and this Moore General Hospital. And it was on a Sunday afternoon. I can remember warming up. I go, gee, why'd they ever get in this? But in the first inning, I struck out the side. Chandler struck out the side. In the second or third inning, I threw a pitch and something hit. What is it they call it when they have a sore shoulder now? It's a one word, and something tore in their bat. And I know I couldn't get my jacket on for a couple days. And I was so dumb that I didn't go to a local orthopedist and get that analyzed. Well, that was what would haunt me over my baseball career. And I can so well remember George Bennett saying that was the head of the humerus, supraspinatus tendon. But there's another word that I'll think of. That anytime anybody's got shoulders, now they use that word. But that, I pitched in Germany. We had a team that spring. Not a bit of trouble. Thought I was okay. Went down to Norfolk, had no trouble whatsoever, and was really throwing hard, and thought, boy, I'm okay. And then the next year at Newark, thought I was okay till a couple of games into the season when suddenly that old injury popped up, and it haunted me all the way through. One thing I might mention, sometimes you play with players in the big league and the minor leagues that you don't recognize at the time, but they were destined to move on and become great players. Newport News had Bill Hodges, he was a catcher. Chuck Connors, the rifleman, he was the first baseman. Then at Elmira,